Great. Thanks, John. And also thank you to the organizing committee for allowing me to give this talk here. As John said, I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Arizona, Charlie Kilpatrick. And I'm going to be talking to you a little bit today about a survey that I conducted for galactic supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions. And this is research that I conducted with John Beeging and my PhD advisor, George Rieke. So just to give a brief outline, there haven't been a lot of talks that touched on this very specifically, so I'll just give a brief overview of what are supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions, why do we expect them to occur, how do we observe them. I'll give a motivation for my survey and talk a little bit about what I observed early on in the interactions and what I wanted to observe with my survey. I'll give an overview of the methods that I used using carbon monoxide, and finally I'll get to the meat and potatoes, probably what most people are interested in, application to supernova remnant properties and also gamma ray emission. So this model, giant molecular clouds collapse into OOB associations, and some of these OOB stars are going to explode as supernova remnants eventually. So this model has been known and understood for a long time, going all the way back to Elmer Green and Latta. But it gives us an idea for why supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions should occur. Maybe they should be preferentially associated with core collapse supernovae. Maybe they should even occur at roughly the fraction, the rate at which core collapse supernovae occur, two-thirds or maybe three-quarters. And of course, when I talk about supernova remnant and molecular cloud interactions, I'm in general talking about a direct interaction between a supernova remnant shock and a molecular cloud, which shocks and compresses and heats the molecular material, creating OH masers in some cases, and turbulently broaden molecular lines from the shocked gas. So really the two main methods that we use to search for these interactions are shocked line emission, for example, from OH masers, as seen here toward W28, and then also broaden molecular features, as I'm showing here toward 3C391. So these two methods are really complementary, and it's good to use them in conjunction, but they have different pros and cons. So when you see a shocked brightened line emission, for example, in the OH maser, it's really easy to correlate that with a molecular shock. And when it occurs towards a supernova remnant, it's pretty straightforward to say, oh, this is a supernova remnant molecular cloud interaction. The problem is that because these observations, for example, there are other masers or other shock excited lines you can use, but these observations in particular occur at low frequency. And so you really need long integrations to get the dim OH masers. You need interferometry to get exact positions. And because of the shock excitation conditions, this isn't going to occur over the entire remnant. CO, on the other hand, or other molecular lines, tend to be intrinsically bright. And so you can get decent resolution just with single dish observations like I did here toward 3C391. There's an interaction going on right here. Velocities are also easy to get because the CO is bright, but the difficulty is really in extracting the shock broadened molecular features from the narrow emission. So this is what I'm going to be talking about for the majority of this talk, and some of the difficulties and the ways around that I had in disentangling all these different features. So one of the first remnants that I observed is probably my favorite object, Cassiopeia A. This is a 12 CO map, and I'm overlaying 20 centimeter radio contours right here. And there's two things that I'd really like to point out about this 12 CO map that I published here in this 2014 paper on FJ. So this cloud to the west right here is really interesting. There appears to be a shock broadened feature right here in the cloud to the west. And why is that interesting? Well, it corresponds almost exactly, with a local enhancement in the radio continuum. And if you're familiar with the New Star and Chandra hard X-ray images, this is also an enhancement in the non-thermal emission. That's really exciting because it might indicate that there's a shock interaction going on between the western part of Cassiopeia A and this bright molecular cloud. That also agrees with the ejecta velocities that we see here. They're significantly decelerated. So there might be something over here that Cassiopeia A is bouncing off of to the west. One other thing that I'd like to point out, and this is a really tentative result, something that we published in this paper, but there's another cloud down here to the southwest. You'll see it's well beyond the shock front as seen in radio emission. And it's exhibiting similar broadening in the CO molecular features relative to just the ambient molecular gas. You can see it's a lot narrower. So is there an interaction going on down here? And what actually would this cloud be interacting with from the supernova remnant? Well, as you might have seen from Danny's talk or from other talks previously this week, there's an outflow coming out here to the southwest of Cass A and ejecta. And a corresponding outflow to the northeast. And so we hypothesized, and this really needs to be followed up in higher excitation molecular lines, that there's an interaction going on between the ejecta, not just the shock front, but the ejecta in Cassiopeia. We go through a few energetic arguments, and it seems to sort of pan out. I encourage you to read this paper. I'm not going to go into too much more detail on Cass A, I'd also like to plug a recent paper I had on the archive on Cass A where we talk about a method for measuring the magnetic field in this region. So just moving beyond our studies of individual remnants, we want to build up our statistics of supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions to compare it to things that you guys are interested in, like supernova remnant properties, gamma ray emission, and such. And even beyond that, we want to be able to connect this to galaxy-wide processes. So when I talk to my galaxy theorist friends, of which there are a lot at Arizona, they don't really want to know about the supernova remnants per se. They want to know about how they contribute to processes going on in the galaxy, like star formation, stellar feedback. They want to know about the cosmic ray pressure term in the Milky Way galaxy. So if our ambitions are to connect supernova remnants to processes, larger processes in general, we really need to have a quantitative statistical understanding of supernova remnant interactions in the ISM, and in particular supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions. So some specific science questions that I had when I was conducting my survey were just really simple that I could answer with a survey overall for supernova remnant molecular cloud interactions. How many are interacting with molecular clouds? That's easy. How do these this population, how does it trend in size, apparent size, and radial flux? Also pretty easy. And then comparing to these really nice recent gamma ray surveys, like the Fermi First Supernova Remnant Catalog and HESS, how do these interactions correlate with sites of GEV and TEV gamma rays? And I'll get to that at the end of the talk. So this is my survey. I conducted a survey toward 50 supernova remnants in the first two quadrants of the galaxy in 12 CO2 to 1 to look for these broad molecular features. I restricted myself to remnants with an apparent size smaller than 20 arc minutes. So of course it's going to bias me, or skew me rather, to more distant, intrinsically smaller supernova remnants, potentially younger supernova remnants. But just bear that in mind. That was a necessary component of the survey to get a large number. There are four that I included in my sample with sizes that are actually greater than this, and I don't include those in the overall statistics. These are just remnants like IC443 and HB3, where I already had 12 CO 2 to 1 data. I conducted these observations on the 10-meter submillimeter telescope at Mount Graham, right next door to the LBT, which would be over here from this picture. And I published all these results in AppJ. So for more details on the survey parameters, please read my 2016 paper. Okay, so how do I select broad molecular lines from my 12 CO data cubes? So basically, I just did the most simple thing I could think of. Go through each data cube pixel by pixel, set a noise floor, pick out local maxima, say these are CO features, these are individual clouds that I'm resolving in the CO spectra, and then just measure their properties across the individual spectra. Slightly more complicated than that, but that's the bare bones explanation. So The clouds that I set as broad molecular with broad molecular features, perhaps indicative of supernova remnant interaction, will really strongly depend on how I define what's broad based on the features that I measure from these individual lines. So to sort of justify that, I used a cut in the noise floor at about 3 times the RMS antenna temperature that I measured. And then I set 6 kilometers per second as the width above which I would say that a CO cloud is broad. So how do I justify that? Well, there are a number of values in the literature that I could point to. I could just, this was actually in part just based on my own intuition from looking at initial studies with CAS-A. But there's also a theoretical prediction that molecular clouds have a size velocity dispersion relation. It's actually pretty tight over several orders of magnitude. And if you just take a cut where most clouds lie at around a couple kilometers per second, you'll see you're encompassing the vast majority of molecular clouds along this size dispersion relation. So this is a few kilometers per second above that, and really the only clouds that would intrinsically have 6 kilometers per second line widths are really the most massive GMCs, which we would very easily be able to pick out in our survey. So these are some of the results. We found 17 out of 46 molecular clouds with line broadening. These are two examples from my survey. I found nine SNRs that previously had undetected broad molecular lines, either because in all cases, because there weren't any detailed CO maps toward these remnants. The full list is given in my paper, but you can see there's a pretty tight correlation between locations of radio brightening in the remnants, as seen here in the 20 centimeter contours, and the locations where I'm finding broad molecular features. And I didn't select these based on where did remnants appear to be interacting with molecular clouds morphologically. There was no morphological selection that went into making these maps. This is just based on my pixel-by-pixel analysis. These are the spectra, so it's pretty subtle. You can see that this is the broad molecular line in black and in comparison in red. And so it's a pretty subtle comparison making between the just ambient molecular gas as shown in red versus the broad molecular gas in black. So one of the main results was that the fraction of interactions is significantly less than the fraction of core collapse supernovae. And at first glance, it might sort of be intuitively obvious. We know of a lot of remnants, for example, from this paper by John Dickel, of a remnant in the LMC that's exploding into a carved out region, an H2 region. So possibly a lot of remnants are exploding into cleaned out areas. There are also a lot of runaway stars. The vast majority of high mass stars have a high binary fraction. And so maybe a lot of stars get kicked out from their birthplace and end up not interacting with a molecular cloud. Both of these effects suggest some sort of interaction timescale. I'll skip over this, but just to sort of cut to the chase, I tried constrain the interaction time scale by looking at the apparent size and the flux density of supernova remnants without interactions and with interactions. And this seems to indicate that supernova remnants with interactions are skewed toward both smaller apparent sizes and brighter radio fluxes at 1 gigahertz. And so that both of these results agree with a much higher ambient density. These are just sort of very simple scaling relations, but we know that remnants with high ambient densities should be smaller from deceleration, and remnants with higher ambient densities should be brighter just from converting the kinetic energy to radiation. So I'm not really able to constrain any effect in age distribution and get to this interaction timescale question, but it would be interesting to sort of ply out the systematic effects from the survey and start to try to answer questions about ages and interaction timescale. So finally, just getting to the gamma ray emission, I would be remiss if I did not talk about this at this conference. This model has been gone over many, many times at this conference. I'd just like to say I was very interested in testing the hadronic model and correlation between remnants with molecular cloud interactions and the very high energy gamma rays, as also seen here toward this is W28 from several years ago. So I just took GEV sources from the Fermi First Supernova Remnant Catalog published within the last year. And just made the same sort of histogram plots. You can see the GEV sources from remnants with interactions are skewed toward maybe slightly higher GEV energies. This is, again, possibly plagued by some systematics, but it appears just from this sort of initial analysis that the GEV sources are brighter in remnants with interactions. And then I also did a sort of similar analysis using Hess TEV sources. These might not all be positively associated with supernova remnants. We heard earlier this week that there's really only 8 Hess sources that are really strongly positively associated with supernova remnants. But I took sources from Ann Bacow and Joaquin Hahn's PhD theses detected above 2 sigma significance. And it seems as though the TEV sources are skewed actually toward dimmer sources and remnants with interactions. So maybe this is an indication that where remnants interact with molecular clouds, the shock speed is decelerated, and you're not able to get up to quite the very highest energy particle acceleration and gamma rays. So I'll just summarize here. I found 19 supernova remnants or out of 50, or 17 out of 46 with signs of molecular cloud interactions, including 9 new ones. That's in the 2016 paper. The number of supernova remnants is actually pretty low compared to the core collapse fraction, but it's difficult to tell whether some correlation exists with age, where we can start flying at why is this? Why? Yeah, is there not a larger fraction of remnants interacting with the molecular clouds? And there appears to be a correlation with GEV gamma ray sources, but these interactions are anti-correlated with TEV sources. And finally, this is my last slide. I advertised that there would be CO3 to 2 data. This was all of this analysis was based on CO2 to 1 data. But I really like this plot. This is 3C391 and 20 centimeter emission, and then the contours in 2 to 1 overlaid. And you can see there's this cloud to the south, again, where we know there's a shock interaction. But when you go to 3 to 2, that's really the only thing that's bright. So obviously line ratios are another great tool to use to detect these interactions. And the Dempsey survey published recently will be a good way to constrain that. So that's it, thank you.
Knox.
So I thought this was very interesting, but I wondered in these results about trends with TEV and GEV sources whether these were statistically significant. Did you do things like KS tests to show that those distributions are actually not the same for the ones that interact and ones that don't?
No, these are very preliminary results. I haven't gone into a lot of details about whether this is statistically significant. This is not published analysis yet, but I just thought I'd show this if it was of any interest to anyone.
Sure, I understand.
So for CASA, it showed some interaction that seemed to be very far away from the shock of CASA.
We claim that there's a possible interaction right here, but as I said, there's an outflow to the southwest of CASA, including a lot of material that's at 10,000 or more kilometers per second.
So another way to do that is maybe if you have escaping cosmic rays, they generate Alphane waves, which may also hit there.
Yeah, that's also possible. You could be getting cosmic rays accelerated from this location, and I haven't done the energetic arguments yet, but that would be interesting to look into.
Okay, thank you. You saw this in Cas-A. Were there other remnants where there seemed to be an offset between the remnant and some kind of interaction?
No, actually, I looked through my whole sample just one by one, and Cas-A was the only one, maybe because the eject velocities are still so high in Cas-A compared to other remnants. That was the only one where I saw this sort of effect.
All right, thank you very much. Before we break.